Visit Maine.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, the National Hurricane Center and computer models have shifted the forecast track for that massive hurricane, Florence, noticeably to the south and to the west, but it doesn't mean that North Carolina, Virginia, and South Carolina are in the clear. The official track is Florence hovering off the southern northern North Carolina coast tomorrow until landfall, making landfall Saturday morning or so, and then veering south through South Carolina and Georgia on Monday. Florence will bring with it 9-foot storm surges and huge amounts of rain, perhaps as much as 4 feet in some areas. Florence has winds that have been clocked at 140 miles an hour. If it does make landfall in North Carolina, it would become the northernmost Category 4 storm to hit since the start of record-keeping going back to 1851. We're joined now by Jeff Goodell, who is the author of a book about rising sea levels and global warming called The Water Will Come. He's also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, where he's written a new story saying that Florence is a warning of what's to come as the climate changes. And Jeff Goodell joins us on the phone right now. Jeff, thanks for coming on. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you mean when you say that Florence is a warning of what's to come?
Well, for a long time, climate scientists have been predicting that as we heat up the planet, that's going to lead to bigger, wetter, more intense storms. We've seen that recently with, Maria and with Harvey last year. And I think that we're seeing it again here with Florence. I mean, obviously, there's been big storms forever. And the hurricane itself is not caused by our warming planet. But the warmer ocean waters and the higher sea level rise are making these storms just more intense and more damaging.
You say in that Rolling Stone piece, you say Florence is not simply a natural disaster, it's a manufactured catastrophe, a product of choices we've made about how we live, where we live, now we think or don't think about the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because, you can imagine a hurricane sweeping through North Carolina 500 years ago. There wouldn't be a whole lot of damage. There would be trees down and things like that, but, it would be a sort of natural phenomenon. The problem is that we've built a lot of houses, a lot of infrastructure right on the water. We've, especially in the Virginia and Carolina area, there's been a lot of building out in low-lying areas along the coast. And all of these houses and infrastructure are sort of in harm's way. And we've really done a kind of poor job of thinking about how we build our world, given the changes that are coming our way and are coming very rapidly and, in fact, are already here.
Yeah, I mean, the lowlands in South Carolina that are right near the coast and then the barrier islands in North Carolina just seem so susceptible to major damage if this storm comes across or comes ashore as people fear. And you add to it the hog farms and you add to it the toxic waste sites, the hazardous waste sites that are there in eastern North Carolina and eastern South Carolina. This could become huge.
Absolutely. And, it's hopefully a real wake-up call for us. I speak broadly when I say us, I mean, America, to think differently about how we build our world given the changes that are coming to our climate. Sea level rise is a fact. It is happening and it's going to accelerate. These kinds of storms, we're going to get more of them and bigger and wetter storms. Same thing in the West with these wildfires that we're seeing. And this is what, the head scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, basically the top science agency in America, calls the new normal. We're shifting and have shifted into a kind of different climate realm, and we need to build and think about our lives much differently in that context.
Well, our guest is Jeff Goodell. He's written a new book called The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff, you point out in your Rolling Stone article yesterday, you point out that North Carolina 6 years ago, banned the government and developers from using climate science to plan for sea level rise. They're not the only ones that are doing this. President Trump recently said that he's no longer interested in seeing the auto companies achieve better mileage standards and therefore reducing global greenhouse gases. We've got a governor here who at least reportedly has banned the use of climate change by state employees. North Carolina seems to be in denial, but there's a whole bunch of politicians that seem to be in denial.
Yeah, it is. There certainly are. And it's one of the sort of great tragedies of our time. And I don't say this, you know, as some kind of knee-jerk environmentalist or anything, you know. I mean, I was an NRA member when I was 8. I'm not a kind of crazy environmentalist, but I am someone who believes in science. And the science of climate change, the science that tells us that burning fossil fuels is radically changing our climate and doing so quickly, is very straightforward. It's not complicated. It's as real as gravity. But this is a sort of inconvenient truth, to steal Al Gore's phrase, for a lot of politicians who, for a variety of reasons, don't want to admit this, whether it's because they take donations from fossil fuel industries, because it requires developers to build buildings and things in a different way that they don't want to do. There's a whole host of reasons why, you know, this has become this sort of political divide in America. But, you know, physics doesn't really care about political divides in America. This is going to happen. This is happening. And the sooner we sort of acknowledge it, the better. I mean, the best sort of vision of this that I came across in reporting my book was I was at Norfolk Naval Station, which is right now right in the crosshairs of Hurricane Florence. And I was talking to the commander of the base there, and he talked openly and frankly about sea level rise and about the risks that they face there. And he said, we deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. And if that were the sort of mantra for politicians in America, I think we'd be in a lot better shape.
Is there a danger that that Norfolk naval base will have to close because of rising seas?
Well, there's not only a danger, there's a certainty. I mean, I was standing on the deck of a battleship with then Secretary of State John Kerry, who understands the risks of sea level rise very well. And he asked the base commander directly, how long does this base have given the fact of sea level rise? And the base commander said 20 to 40 years. And that may sound like a long time, but it's really not when you think about this base. It's the largest naval base in the world. 75,000 people work there. It's the centerpiece for all of our operations in the Middle East and in Europe. It's vital to America's defense system. And it's going to have to be moved because of rising seas. And the Navy knows this.
Well, we have our own base here in Tampa, MacDill Air Force Base, and you talk about the Middle East. U.S. Central Command and other commands are headquartered at MacDill. MacDill is only, at best, 3 or 4 feet above sea level. What's it cost to move a military base?
Well, I mean, it's billions of dollars, of course. You know, airstrips air bases are a little bit easier to move than naval bases because the whole port structure and things. The Norfolk base is particularly complicated because, you know, I mean, the Navy has plenty of money, right? It's not the cost per se that is the problem. And at a naval base like Norfolk, you know, they could build walls, elevate piers, do all the kinds of things that one might do to protect and kind of defend against rising seas. But the problem is it doesn't do any good to sort of make the naval base itself into a fortress if the 75,000 people who work there can't get to work because the entire region is flooded, or if all the railroad lines that bring the munitions and the steel and all the other equipment and supplies that the base needs are all underwater. So when it comes to sort of defending the base, you really have to defend sort of all of that region of Virginia. And, you know, that's an incredible task that, frankly, the military is not legally allowed to get involved in civil affairs to that level anyway. So it becomes a much more complex question than just like, oh, let's build some walls and put up some seawalls and elevate some piers and we'll be fine.
Jeff Goodell is our guest, and his book is The Water Will Come. Jeff, is it too late? I mean, have we already poured too much carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere that there's no turning back? It's just going to get worse for the next 100 years?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by too late. I mean, it's certainly not too late in the sense of I'm not a catastrophist. I don't think that this is the end of human civilization or anything like that, like some people would suggest. But it is... because of the way CO2 goes into the atmosphere and stays there, it's not like traditional air pollution that, you know, you get smog in the air and then someone invents catalytic converters and cleans up cars and the air pollution goes away. CO2 stays in the atmosphere for hundreds and in some cases thousands of years. So, and we've already warmed up the planet a lot. That's why my book is called The Water Will Come, because there's sea level rise is a certainty. Even if we all sold our SUVs and rode skateboards to work tomorrow, we would still see significant sea level rise. So there's a whole lot of changes that are sort of coming either way. But that does not mean that it's not worthwhile to reduce carbon emissions to get to zero as soon as possible, because that will help to scale down the size of the change that we're going to have and the duration of it.
Jeff, you spent a lot of time in Miami, and in fact, when you wrote a piece about Miami eventually becoming like a new Atlantis for Rolling Stone a few years ago, you were on WIMNF on this radio station talking about it. Miami shows up in your book, The Water Will Come, several times. We're entering into the king tide season. Tell us what Miami is experiencing right now in terms of sea level rise.
Well, I mean, sea level rise manifests. Some people think of sea level rise as though that, you know, that, you know, you mentioned Atlantis and this notion that, oh, you know, all of a sudden the water will come up like a tsunami and, you know, there'll be sharks swimming through the lobby of the Fontainebleau Hotel or something like that. Sea level rise really manifests itself in the way that we see it already in many places in South Florida and in the King Tides in Miami. You can see it very clearly, just a sort of incremental high. It's higher and higher, all more often, and every year. And that's what sort of sea level rise looks like, is this sort of incremental climb year after year that is not, it's not like, oh, there's a high tide, and then there's 5 years worth of, you know, the tides are lower, and then it comes back up again, or there's some kind of, you know, rhythm to it. I mean, we're going to see progressively higher and higher king tides, higher and higher high tides. And the speed of that change, you know, is you know, the billion-dollar question. You know, the projections are for 3 feet. The low end is like 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, and the high end is like 8 or 9 feet. So the rate of the change is debatable. But what we're going to see and what we do see in Miami right now is sort of there's more flooding there now than there was 5 years ago on King Tide. And there's going to be more flooding on King Tide and on other high tides in 5 years and in 5 years after that. So it's this incremental change.
There was an article in the Miami Herald over the weekend that said that there's a shortage of workers in Miami because they're building so many projects in Miami. And, you know, the last time I was down in Miami, construction cranes filled the sky. I mean, some in Miami get it, and you write about them in your book. Some don't get it because this building boom is going on. There are some, I think, visionary people mentioned in your book that are trying to prepare for the inevitable, this 3 to 9 foot sea rise by the end of the century. Talk about some of the people you profile in your book, The Water Will Come.
Well, first, let me say that the building boom in Miami is, you know, a phenomenon that, you know, despite these risks, the building boom on the coast is continuing. And, you know, part of the reason is a kind of need to keep tax revenues up. So the building boom needs to go on for the city and the county to have money to do other things. And part of it is because it's appealing to an audience, to buyers who don't really care about what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years. Certainly 10 years, you know, a lot of foreign money, a lot of people who think of it as a place to be for a little while, and then they will move on. And frankly, a lot of them are wealthy enough that they don't care if they lose some incremental value in the in their real estate over that amount of time because they can afford it. But there are a lot of people there, or there are a number of people that I've met there who architects, like a man named Bernardo Borges, who's a really well-known architect there, who, you know, is doing everything he can to encourage developers to build in a completely different way, starting with simple things like eliminating underground parking, which in a world of flooding and sea level rise is, you know, pretty insane, to, you know, elevating the buildings, putting the infrastructure higher up so that it's away from flooding, encouraging building, developing on what marginally higher ground there is in Miami-Dade County, and, you know, really stopping the building in sort of low-lying areas that are hugely at risk, especially in places in South Miami-Dade County.
Phil Levine, the guy who just ran for governor here in Florida, lost in the Democratic primary. He's a former Miami Beach city mayor. He was one of these people that you talk about in your book who at least is trying to do something to prepare Miami for the future.
Yeah, I mean, so Phil Levine, you know, is really notable for, making the sea level rise a public issue. He helped push forward a bond, about $500 million of the bonds to fund improved drainage for Miami Beach, a pump system to help pump out the high water, and to begin elevating by 2 feet a number of blocks of real estate in Sunset Harbor, an area where he happened to actually own some real estate. This has been, you know, it's a step in the right direction. It's at best a kind of Band-Aid in the short term. It's been controversial now. There's a lot of pushback about whether this was the sort of right strategy to use, whether this was money well spent. We'll see how that plays out in the future. I mean, I think this is one of the things you're going to see is that, you know, a lot of projects that are, you know, not as well thought out as they should be, short-term fixes rather than real long-term planning. And that's the real challenge, given the sort of political system and election cycles that we have, is to think about this in a long-term way. What's the long-term vision for Miami Beach, for South Miami-Dade County? What are we going to do about the port there? What's going to happen with the airport, which is on very low ground? How are we going to rethink our, you know, the sort of development of this area to encourage people not to flee as real estate values begin to decline with increased flooding? And that's the hard thing to come up with right now.
Well, that's the odd thing, too. I mean, there's two kind of people that are really going to be affected by these storm surges that we're going to see this weekend and by the future sea level rises. The very rich who have their houses on the waterfront. And the poor that live in areas like South Carolina's lowlands, who live maybe in rural agricultural communities, but it's very low, it's next to swamps, and both those groups are going to be ultimately affected by sea level rise here in the U.S. and then around the world.
Yeah, and that's what really concerns me a lot is, I'm really not so concerned about people who own condos in Miami Beach and what that means to them, because as I said, a lot of them are kind of wealthy, they can afford it, they can move quickly, you know, most of them are well-informed about this, and if they're not, that's sort of their own fault. What I'm concerned about is even in places like Miami-Dade County, places like Hialeah and Sweetwater, which are, you know, a long way, you know, 7 or 8 miles from the coast, working-class neighborhoods, where people think that the risks are, that there isn't really any risk, but in fact, there's a tremendous amount of risk, because what's going to happen, as all the sort of modeling, even the most basic modeling shows, is that the water will come in from the west side also as the Everglades begin to flood out. And places like Hialeah and other areas in western Miami-Dade County are, in fact, even more at risk than the stuff that's right on the coast. So there's a lot of people who have, you know, their entire, people who have worked really hard all their lives, have all their investment in their homes, the kind of American dream idea, we're going to see the value of that home decline significantly in the next decade or so because of this risk and increased flooding. And as people begin to factor the reality of this into how they think about real estate investment and things, it's going to have a big impact in the very near term. And I'm really concerned about that.
Well, Jeff Goodell is on the phone with us. His book is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. He's also written a new piece that's on the Rolling Stone website called Hurricane Florence is a Warning of What's to Come. And the subhead is, as another catastrophic hurricane bears down on the U.S., President Trump continues to stifle any plan that could slow down climate change. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and online we're at WMNF.org. I'm Rob Lurie. This is Radioactivity. If you've got a question for Jeff, you can email it into the studio here at DJ@WMNF.org. You write a kind of an apocalyptic, you wrote one, an apocalyptic piece about Miami in the future in 2037. What happens when Miami is hit by a major hurricane in your mind in 2037? What's the worst that could happen?
Well, I mean, the worst is, that could happen is think about something like what we're seeing with Hurricane Florence right now, a big, slow-moving Category 4 or 5 storm that's pushing a lot of water. In this case, you know, storm surges could be anywhere, you know, 7, 8, 9. I saw an estimate this morning of as high as 15 feet. And when you think about that kind of, storm surge, and then you think about, you know, another, you know, foot and a half or so of sea level rise, which would give it even more, you know, this storm surges on top of that, you know, it would really devastate Miami. In a way that we have not seen a storm do in Miami. Even, you know, there was the big storm in the 20s, but, you know, it hasn't happened. And the real question that's going to come up soon in when we have big storms like this, and is going to, I think, even come up after Hurricane Florence, is given the risks that we know that are to come as these rise, how are we going to rebuild? Are we going to rebuild in the same way, in the same places? Or are we going to say, look, we need to think differently about this? And I think if a big storm hits Miami, that's what's going to happen, because it's become very clear to anybody who thinks openly about this and clearly about this that, you know, when you think about long-term, about sea level rise, Miami's in South Miami, or South Florida is in big trouble. And so a big hurricane will give us the opportunity to political leaders the opportunity to maybe, in the best sense, rebuild in a different way and change the sort of structure and development of the city. And that's the sort of most optimistic scenario about what would happen with a big storm hitting South Florida.
Jeff, do you have any more time, or do you got to go?
I got a few more minutes.
All right. I just want to ask you, you know, we have king tides here in the Tampa Bay area. They're not as bad yet as they are in Miami. Miami, the king tide season, I think, begins in October. But there are king tides here in the Tampa Bay area. You talk in your book, The Water Will Come, about the kind of cavalier nature that some people walk through the king tides with in the streets of Miami Beach, and how dangerous it is. Why is it dangerous to walk through flooded streets in Miami Beach?
Well, it's not just some people who walk through the streets, it's me. I mean, while I was reporting this book, I was out with a scientist who was testing, you know, when you have king tides in a neighborhood, when a neighborhood floods, you know, this is a neighborhood that was not built to be submerged. We did not build, the neighborhood that I was in called Miami Shores, you know, it's a middle-class neighborhood near the water, but it was not built to be aquatic, right? So there's septic tanks there, and when the floods come in, those septic tanks flood also. And when those septic tanks flood, as anyone understand who knows about how septic tanks work, you know, they leach out all of their bacteria and everything. So I was wandering through the Miami Shores when there was a foot and a half of water or so there, the scientist I was with suggested that I, like, not do this without putting on, you know, big rubber boots. And I was like, nah, that's no big deal. And after he tested the water, the bacteria count in the water was 10,000 times the safe exposure level for E. coli bacteria. And luckily, I didn't have any infections or didn't get any infections. But, you know, there were kids playing in the water thinking, oh, look, you know, look, Mom, the oceans come into our backyard. How fun. And in fact, you know, that water is highly polluted. And as we're seeing with Hurricane Florence, I mean, you know, there's a number of Superfund sites that are right on the water in the Carolinas that are at risk right now. When you think about the inundation of a major city, Tampa, Miami, Norfolk, anyway, I mean, it's not like a pretty thing, like, oh, just this, like, wonderful pristine ocean has come in and there's dolphins jumping in the backyard. It's dirty, it's messy, it's full of pollutants, and it's dangerous.
And you point out, too, that septic tanks present a problem for this, but also our regular sanitary sewers don't work right during king tides or during rising sea levels, and they also send human waste into those puddles or into those, you know, those flooded streets that we see.
Right, because, I mean, municipal waste systems are certainly much better in one sense, in that they're, you know, they don't have the same kind of leach lines and everything that a backyard septic system has. But the problem that we've learned in Miami with even municipal septic system, municipal sewage systems, is that the lines that are the city and the county often maintains the main lines quite well, and they do regular tests to see if there's leakage and things like that. But it's the line that takes the drains the sewage from the house to the main lines that are often corroded, broken, leaking. And so when the water comes in, it's essentially the same effect as it picks up this bacteria and stuff out of these lines coming in from the houses and carries it into the floodwaters.
Well, we're talking about rising sea levels, and we're talking also about Hurricane Florence with Jeff Goodell, who wrote a book called The Water Will Come. Jeff is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He's written a bunch of books, including How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix the Earth's Climate, and Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff, I know you got to go, but how about we take one phone call from a listener?
In. Sure, happy to.
All right, so let's go to John in Port Richey, who says his friends don't believe in climate change. John, you're on. What's your question?
Yeah, I've had this discussion with several people that they always say that there's no real science on this. They don't trust the science. They always say that it's, oh, this is just the Earth's cycle, and it's a natural phenomenon. So it's like, how do you convince them that this is proven, or at least pretty well scientifically established fact, when they just won't believe it? I even bring up the fact that they used core samples from, what was it, the Arctic or the Antarctic, to show the increase in carbon dioxide since the industrial age. So it's like, how do you convince these people that this is human activity that's driving this?
All right, John, great question. Thanks a lot. Jeff?
Well, it is a great question, and it's a question that I'm sorry to say I have no answer for. You know, there's nothing that you can say or that I can say in a 2 or 3 minute conversation that is going to kind of convince someone that, you know, science is real. You know, I've found that people who, I mean, this whole phrase of even believing in climate change is sort of like saying, do you believe in gravity? I mean, it's just a physical fact. It's not with climate change, it's not a question of sort of belief. It's a question of what the science has demonstrated. The science is, you know, the basic science of climate change is so very simple. You know, the idea that, you know, when you burn fossil fuels, it creates carbon dioxide. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that carbon dioxide molecule traps heat. You know, the whole greenhouse gas, you know, phenomenon was, you know, established 150 years ago. I mean, this is not complicated science, really. But people choose not to believe it for various reasons. You know, some people, it's religious feelings about the nature of fossil fuels, that fossil fuels were put here by God for humans to burn, and God would not have put it here if it was going to wreck our planet, or for political reasons because, you know, they have a friend who works in the fossil fuel industry or something like that, or for a variety of reasons, maybe just because they're ill-informed, maybe because they're afraid of the changes that this might bring to their lives. There's many, many, many reasons why people choose to deny this sort of obvious reality. And I've just decided that for myself that, you know, as I said, there's nothing that I can say that will convince someone in a minute or two. So I'm really focusing my efforts and my communications on people who understand that this is real, that the science is happening, that the science is real, that that our climate is changing, and to help them understand what the risks really are, what we're really thinking about, you know, what scientists are projecting, and how best to think about their own future and the future of their kids.
Well, President Trump thinks it's a trick by the Chinese. He thinks it's a trick by the Chinese to put us at a disadvantage technology-wise. Do the Chinese acknowledge that there is...
Of course. China, I've spent a lot of time in China. China completely gets it, and they understand that it's a great, you know, that their understanding of this and Trump's denial of this is a great competitive advantage for them. I mean, they're investing hugely in solar energy, electric cars, use there, and development is going through the roof. They understand that fossil fuels are going to be quickly phased out, and that the future, economic future, belongs to those who acknowledge that and are preparing for this sort of new energy revolution.
Do we have the do we have the necessary technology now? I mean, if we put the best of our technology in use right now, can we get to zero carbon dioxide emissions?
Sure. I mean, you know, I mean, it's rebuilding our energy system is not something that you can do, you know, like redoing your house. You know, it's a massive project. But, you know, the sort of most plausible goal and, the, you know, a goal that if we could hit would be, you know, huge and would save us a lot of sort of future grief would be that even if we could get to sort of zero carbon emissions by 2050, which is, you know, more than 30 years away, that's a very ambitious goal. But I think, you know, I think it's widely viewed among energy experts that if we tried, we could do it. I mean, a great example of this is Puerto Rico, which, of course, was wiped out by Hurricane Maria last year and essentially wiped out the entire electric grid there. And, you know, that electric grid in Puerto Rico was completely powered by fossil fuels, mostly imported diesel oil and some coal and some natural gas. But a lot of studies have shown that, you know, they could rebuild the entire grid in Puerto Rico, you know, using solar and other renewables and just a tiny little bit of natural gas for basically the same cost as they would if they did a kind of conventional fossil fuel kind of system. So there's been so much progress on clean energy, renewable energy, wind and solar and microgrids that help distribute energy in different kinds of ways, that the cost is no longer an issue. It's really about political will.
Well, Jeff Goodell, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a great conversation.
Thanks, Jeff. And we'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Yep.
All right. That's Jeff Goodell, who's a contributing writer for Rolling Stone magazine. He's got a book out that is now out in paperback. It's called The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. He really makes a compelling case that climate change is already here, and there are numerous examples around the country and around the world that we should look at. Some people, as he talked about there in that interview, are already doing things to protect against climate change, especially in the Miami area. He's got a new piece, too, on Rolling Stone magazine, their website. Hurricane Florence is a warning of what's to come. That's the title of that piece. Well, let's open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. I'm Rob Lurie. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa and online at WMNF.org. And let's listen to what Reverend Pat Robertson said. Well, he's not a reverend, but he is a television preacher. Let's listen to what he said on Monday night about Hurricane Florence. This is what he called on God to do about the hurricane.
I don't want that thing to come in. I don't want it to hurt Region. I don't want it to hurt CBN. I don't want it to tear up these beautiful campus. I don't want to tear these trees down. I don't want to see any damage. I don't want a bunch of glass flowing. And I don't want all over this area that's counting on us to pray for them. So I'm going to ask you right now, put your hand out toward the Atlantic, wherever it is, and let's speak a word right now in the name of Jesus. In the name of Jesus, you Hurricane Florence, we speak to you in the name of Jesus, and we command this storm to cease its forward motion and go harmlessly into the Atlantic. Go up north, away from land, and veer off in the name of Jesus.
televangelist Pat Robertson on Monday night telling the hurricane what to do. Let's open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go up to North Carolina, where Mike is in the path, or was in the path yesterday of the hurricane. Maybe it's turning south. Mike, you're on. What would you like to say?
Rob, you're actually going to make me follow that up.
Well, do you think that the televangelist was successful so far?
Well, no. But, you know, Rob, I was happy to hear you touch on the issue of the hog farms. And I did send you a couple of emails to substantiate what I will say. But one of the little-known facts is most of the hog farms here in North Carolina, first, are Chinese-owned. Secondly, they're in areas that are historically black since the Civil War. I mean, these are not newcomers to the area. They've lived there for generations, and they're having their lives absolutely ruined. And for anything you've heard about lawsuits where plaintiffs were awarded millions of bucks, to my knowledge, not one person has collected a penny. And their quality of life is indescribable. When they walk out in their yard, it's like the smell of feces and decaying flesh are just so thick you can cut it. And people are having to live like this, largely in three black counties south of Raleigh. Also, too, I might mention, the amount of hog waste is just mind-blowing. The farmers are allowed to self-report, and over 10 billion gallons per year is self-reported, but there are many studies done to show that's a fraction of what is actually out there. And most of this wastewater is kept in hog lagoons, which are, if this hurricane slams us like it might, these lagoons will overflow, and more than 10 billion gallons of hog waste will go into the estuarial system of North Carolina. And again, here we've got a president saying, make America great, and we've got Chinese dumping their hog feces in our face. So,
Mike, what's the forecast for Asheville? What are you hearing?
Well,
what's coming your way?
You know, having lived in Florida for many a year, I'm always prepared, so I'll have friends during the hurricane. But I don't think we're going to get but a few inches of rain. But, you know, frankly, some wind and rain. We'll probably get 30 miles an hour with 3 or 4 inches of rain. But, you know, that's one nice thing about living in the mountains. A hurricane coming in on the Atlantic coast is 500 miles away, and you've got a lot of impediments to slow the storm down, especially Mount Mitchell.
Are you seeing a flood of refugees coming to Asheville, people that are escaping from the barrier islands going to Asheville to stay in hotels?
I'm expecting that, but I haven't really noticed it so far. I do know that interstates in South Carolina are now only doing traffic out of South Carolina.
One way out, yeah.
Yes. But it's, you know, once again, I mean, this is a man-made problem with the hog issue, and you just can't describe it. I mean, your red tide is terrible, and I accept that, but hog waste issue is an unimaginable problem.
Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Has covered this several times in the last year and done really great interviews with people who are living next to hog farms. Mike?
There's a part of me that almost wants the worst to happen, but I don't think with the government we have that he would just lie and say it all went well.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot. Be safe.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's Mike in North Carolina. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. President Trump was asked yesterday about his response to Hurricane Florence, and he talked about his administration's past responses to hurricanes. Let's listen into what President Trump said yesterday.
It's incredible. Do you have any questions for Secretary Nielsen or for Brock Longquist?
What lesson do we take from what happened in Puerto Rico? How do we apply the lessons we took from Puerto Rico?
Well, I think Puerto Rico was incredibly successful. Puerto Rico was actually our toughest one of all because it's an island, so you can't truck things onto it. Everything's by boat. We moved a hospital into Puerto Rico, a tremendous military hospital in the form of a ship. You know that. And I actually think, and the governor's been very nice, and if you ask the governor, he'll tell you what a great job. I think probably the hardest one we had by far was Puerto Rico because of the island nature. And I actually think it was one of the best jobs that's ever been done with respect to what this is all about. Puerto Rico got hit not with one hurricane, but with two. And the problem with Puerto Rico is their electric grid and their electric generating plant was dead before the storms ever hit. It was in very bad shape. It was in bankruptcy, had no money. It was largely, you know, it was largely closed. And when the storm hit, they had no electricity essentially before the storm. And when the storm hit, that took it out entirely. The job that FEMA and law enforcement and everybody did working along with the governor in Puerto Rico, I think, was tremendous. I think that Puerto Rico was an incredible, unsung success. Texas, we have been given A-pluses for. Florida, we've been given A-pluses for. I think in a certain way, the best job we did was Puerto Rico, but nobody would understand that. I mean, it's harder to understand. It was a very hard thing to do because of the fact they had no electric. Before the storms hit, it was dead, as you probably know. So, we've gotten a lot of receptivity, a lot of thanks for the job we've done in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is very important. And by the way, speaking of Puerto Rico, they're going to be affected pretty much pretty soon by something else that's on its way. Is that right?
Potentially Hurricane Isaac right now is tracking south of the island, but we are...
All right. So there's President Trump yesterday taking credit for what he called an incredible incredibly successful response to the hurricane a year ago in Puerto Rico. So what do you think? 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and you can send your email comments into dj@wmnf.org. This is WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Rick in Parrish. Hi, Rick. You're on WMNF. What would you like to comment about?
Hi, Rod. How are you?
Good.
You're making it tough for the callers, you know, because we have to follow Pat Robertson and Donald Trump.
Tough for some, easy for others.
I wanted to actually ask a question to your guest, but I'll put this out there anyway, that I just read that the Trump administration is making it a bit easier to release methane into the atmosphere. My understanding of methane is that it's much more efficient in trapping heat, but that it doesn't last in the atmosphere as long as carbon. So, as we're talking about climate change and, you know, pulling out of the treaties and all of that, it would appear that we're actually, not only are we not helping, we're actually making it worse. So I was wondering if, you know, perhaps there was another caller who could explain to me a bit more about the impacts of releasing more methane into the atmosphere. And I'll just wait offline, and thank you so much, Rob.
All right, Rick, thanks a lot. And in Jeff's article that he wrote for Rolling Stone, I'll just read the passage that would be appropriate for Jeff's comment. Jeff Goodell wrote, on the eve of the storm, the New York Times reports that the EPA is about to roll back restrictions on methane emissions, a potent greenhouse gas. In July, the EPA proposed weakening a rule on carbon dioxide pollution from vehicle tailpipes. And in August of this year, the agency proposed replacing a regulation on coal-fired power plants with a weaker one that will allow far more global warming emissions to flow unchecked from the nation's smokestacks. Let's go back to the phones. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And let's go to Teresa in St. Pete. Hi, Teresa, you're on. What would you like to say?
Pat Robertson, when Katrina hit, didn't he say God was punishing them because of they accepted homosexual people?
I believe he said something like that. Okay. Yeah, I'll have to look for the quote.
And they had a Democratic governor, right?
Katrina? I can't remember when Bobby Jindal started. He was there for a while. I don't know if it was one term or two terms.
I think it was a Democrat. And North Carolina has a Republican, right?
North Carolina now has a Democratic governor.
Oh, has a Democratic governor. Yeah. But the legislation is all Republican, right?
The legislature, because of redistricting, is mostly Republican, yes.
Right. So he prays for the storm to go away from North Carolina, but has no problem with it hitting he doesn't pray to pray.
Well, he's in Virginia, and he wanted to go back out to sea. Apparently, he's been unsuccessful. It's headed for South Carolina, where a lot of Pat Robertson supporters live.
So I think it's a lot of depending on what party's in office that he cares about. And I also wanted to talk about climate change for just a second. When I talk to people that just don't believe any of it, they, I tell them, you may be right. Maybe some of it is just cycles that, the earth goes through. But then I say, but you can't tell me what we're doing to this earth with all the toxins and all the crap we put in the air and the water, that it's not intensifying those cycles and making it a whole lot worse on the climate. And they usually don't have an answer for me. I used to get into that with my dad. And they usually don't have anything to say about that.
All right, Teresa, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Thanks to Bill Grace. He's our phone producer today, and this is Community Radio. Let's go to Charles from Tampa. Charles, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
First of all, I'm just trying to figure out how many brain cells I lost sitting through Trump's making stuff up about hurricane response. But I think I have a beat on what I wanted to say. First of all, kudos to your guest for pointing out that this is like gravity. Acknowledging, we don't believe in climate change. We acknowledge it, much the same way we acknowledge that if we drop a bowling ball above our foot, our toe is going to hurt very soon after. And that's really the only thing I can suggest to people when speaking to people who insist on denying. It's an acknowledgement.
I think just by the numbers, sea levels are rising. So whether or not you think the carbon dioxide, methane gas, and other greenhouse gases are contributing, the problem is sea levels are rising. So what are you going to do about it? You can't deny that. So what are we doing building so many houses and condos so close to the shoreline? What are we doing to make sure that when a storm surge, like 9-foot storm surge, hits South Carolina or the Outer Banks, you're protecting the people and the property and that live there. So the fact that sea level is rising, what are you going to do about it? And I don't see either our governor, our legislature, or our president say anything about making it safer for the citizens of the U.S.
Right. It comes back to what's the worst that could happen if we assume that all the science that we have evidence to show is true is actually true. And it underscores the fact that the right has pretty much become a religion. I mean, they believe things that are ideological and fictional in spite of nothing but evidence showing that it's not true. I mean, there's reality has a liberal bias. And unfortunately, conservatism has devolved into just a religious belief system.
An act of faith, right.
And those of us who aren't part of that religion are infidels and need to be smited, like your caller that had an impeached Trump bumper sticker and wound up replacing it 2 or 3 times until she found a tire iron in her back seat through her rear window. And of course, it's the Antifa that's the violent left wing.
Yeah. So, all right, Charles, thanks a lot. Thanks for the call.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You know, I think there are some thoughtful conservatives out there. And if you're a conservative that thinks that climate change is bunk, or if you're one of those that thinks that climate change is real, feel free to call us. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Steve in Tampa, who wants to talk about FEMA sending $10 million to ICE. That just was reported last night on MSNBC. Steve, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that was revealed on one of the shows late last night and confirmed by a congressman on the Appropriations Committee.
Yeah, Jeff Merkley from Oregon, the senator, the Democrat, yeah.
Yeah, right just before hurricane season started and the money is being used to house immigrants coming illegal or whatever, coming across the border instead of being used for, rescue and relief for American citizens.
Now President Trump said this morning that there's going to be plenty of money for FEMA.
Well, that's $10 million less, and his belief is that we can get out of financial debt by just printing more money. It's pretty shows his lack of understanding of finances.
It seems that we have money for some things and we have no money for other things.
I know, and it's really frightening, and I understand why Woodward's book is called Fear. I some think that's because Trump is afraid of everything, but I truly am afraid at this point, and I'm glad it's going out to all the listeners, because I don't know how many people were aware of that transfer. It's just astounding to me that we're less safe, but you know, they find the money for the things that they find it.
Yeah, you know, I would ask the question, what's it more important to spend money on during hurricane season, FEMA or locking people up and separating families? What's the more important use of money?
Well, so, they've decided. I
all
guess
right, Steve.
Camps are more important. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I'm glad you raised that. Ryan writes this. No one likes to talk about how cow farms are one of the leading causes of greenhouse emissions. Why is that? That's from Ryan, who's an executive chef in Safety Harbor at the Paris French Bistro. So, Ryan, thanks for that. James writes this, I suggest that Pat Robertson sail out into the Atlantic and deliver his message to Hurricane Florence personally. That's James in St. Pete. Another James writes, I'm willing to bet that Pat Robertson in the name of Jesus won't work. I'm taking all the bets, writes James. And 813-239-9663. Some people are sending in messages I can't read on the air because they have some of those four-letter words that we're not allowed to read. DeMarco writes this, the only thing that President Trump, the bogus man, knows how to do is toot his own horn, writes DeMarco. And let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to Bob in Tarpon Springs. So, Bob, thanks for calling WMNF. What's on your mind?
Hey, Rob. It's always baffled me that climate change is a political problem, a left and right thing. You know, with the, let's say, the corporate connections that the right seems to have, why aren't these huge corporations jumping on the opportunity to, you know, make solar cells, you know, work into climate change rather than fighting it?
Well, there are some. I mean, we've got Tesla, the big electric car industry. We've got wind farms and windmills that generate electricity, but done by some of the big companies. And some of the small companies do it too, but I think GE is among those building electric windmills. Our solar cell business has kind of gone in the direction of China. They're manufacturing most of the solar cells. We don't prop up that industry domestically, so China's kind of taken over. But I think there are some companies that have moved in the direction of energy efficiency. I mean, just for the sake of your business, if you can use less electricity and your electric bill is smaller, that's a good thing for your business. So it does make a business sense to use less electricity.
Well, absolutely. But I'm thinking of companies like you know, ExxonMobil. Instead of fighting the inevitable,
they take out ads claiming that they're looking for energy alternatives, but they have a lock on, you know, all this oil that's buried underground that at least for the next, you know, few decades will be safe. So I think they're loath to, I mean, I think they're in a bind too, because if it turns out that some of these court cases against oil companies start to win and they are on the hook for the cost of climate change, and they lose those cases, I mean, they don't want to be, I think ExxonMobil and the other big oil companies don't want to, you know, face that problem. I mean, Miami's problems, theoretically, in a lawsuit, could be tied to the burning of fossil fuels. So what if Miami and Miami Beach sue the oil companies and win for the cost of replacing the infrastructure?
Yeah.
I mean, that would be huge. It would be a huge loss for the oil companies.
Yeah, a lot of people forget that it was, you know, it was a Republican president that signed into law regulation that reduced or pretty much got rid of acid rain. That was, you know, George Bush the senior.
Well, that's way back in ancient history when
well.
I mean I shouldn't laugh. There were, if you look historically at Florida, there were lots of prominent Republicans in the state of Florida that were great environmentalists. They've all seemed to, you know, disappeared. But if you go back to the 80s and 90s, there were a bunch of them.
Yeah,
Yeah, but it's just become everything is us against them,
yeah.
No matter what.
All right,
what
Bob.
The topic is.
Bob, thanks a lot. Thanks. I wish we had more time. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 or record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA in the Midpoint program. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. First, the latest news from National Public Radio.